If you ever went to Sunday school, I'm sure you would have heard more than once the story of Moses and the burning bush. It was an old favourite, certainly in the Sunday school that I attended. But I think the focus was often on Moses, and as we will see this evening, and as Tim reminded us this morning, Exodus really wants us to focus on the God who was behind Moses, in the name of whom he went. And here this evening, then, we've got to observe who God is. We've got to recognize his name, unpack that, and see what it might say to us centuries after this event. But as that reading made clear, this God is the God of all generations, forever and forever. So the God of Moses is also our God. He's the God for us today, as he was for Moses. But we need to set the scene, don't we, really, and to remind ourselves something of the background here. It's been 400 years since Jacob was reunited with Joseph in Egypt. He was concerned about making that journey. But God spoke to him as well, and he said, "Look, I am the God of your father. Don't be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. I will go down to Egypt with you, and I will surely bring you back. I will surely bring you back." And that, of course, lies behind the story of the Exodus. Jacob and his family, perhaps what, 50 people, went 400 years previous to this story, and God had promised he would bring them back. They were to be rescued. They didn't understand that, perhaps, in the context of God speaking to Jacob. But he understood that they were going to go back. Moses has been tending his father's flock for some 40 years, perhaps. He's now wandering around with these sheep. He finds himself now on the western side, the far side of a desert. Or as the older version said, the backside of a desert. And I can remember as a child listening to someone go on about that, but I got the wrong understanding of the backside of the desert. The far side. Not a wilderness, as we might know it, not a pile of sand, but a fertile place where the shepherds would take the sheep from one location to another. And as Moses is moving around with his flock, he encounters this burning bush. Or as one commentator puts it, it's the only burning bush that's not burning, is it? It doesn't actually burn. There we are. And it's there that he has a divine encounter. God speaks to him. God has spoken to his people previously in various ways. But now he's going to speak to Moses. Moses sees this burning bush. People tell us that it perhaps wasn't an unusual sight, for on the hot deserts and the hot sun, often perhaps burning bushes would self-combust in the heat. But as Moses gets closer, he sees that this bush is different. There's no ash. It's not getting any smaller. It's not getting blacker. It's not falling down to the ground. This bush is burning, if you like, but it's not disintegrating. And as he gets even closer, he hears a voice. God speaks to him. "Moses, Moses." "Here I am," says Moses. But then God speaks again and says, "Don't come any closer. You're now approaching holy ground." He's in the very presence of God. The text speaks about the angel of God. And if we were to unpack that further, we can see elsewhere back in Genesis when this angel of the Lord spoke. He spoke on behalf of God. Abraham's about to sacrifice his son Isaac. And God speaks again to him and says, "You have not withheld your son from me." The angel of the Lord speaks in that first person singular. "You haven't withheld your son from me." And here the angel of the Lord, then this voice of God is speaking to Moses. And he's saying to him, take off your sandals, for the place where you're standing is holy ground. Holy ground. But then he tells him who he is. I'm the God of your father and of your ancestors. He reminds him of that. He reminds him of that. I am the God of your father. We heard that this morning, didn't we? If we were to go back into Hebrews, where that list of that list of people of faith is recorded, it speaks of his parents being faithful people, people of faith. However much Moses might have understood of that because of the adoption we'll think of in a moment, nonetheless, his parents were people of faith. And God is reminding him, I'm the God of your father. I'm the God of your father. And for those of us who are brought up perhaps in a Christian environment, how grateful we are that we can speak about our God being the God of our parents, the God of our father, the God of our mother, the God of our grandparents perhaps, even great-grandparents. We can look back on their faith and see something of that. And God is inviting Moses here to look back and to think of what his mother might have said to him as that growing lad, as she was the nursemaid, looking after him on behalf of Pharaoh's daughter. The God of your father, the God of your mother. But then he reminds him, of course, he's not just the God of his father. He's the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob. He's the God of his ancestors, of Jacob in particular, to whom God spoke and said, I will bring you back. I will bring you back. As this passage unfolds, we will see that our God is changeless. We've sung that already. The passage reminds us that our God is the eternal God. He was the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob. And Jesus alludes to that himself, trying to make that connection between his own ministry and the Old Testament, bringing the people together. As he speaks to a largely Jewish community, he tells them that he's here on behalf of the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob. And reminds them that God appeared to Moses at a burning bush. Our God is the only God. But Moses, of course, when he hears the voice, when he sees the burning bush, when he's told to take off his sandals because the ground on which he's standing is holy, he hides his face. He's afraid. He's in the presence of God. Difficult, isn't it? We need to remind ourselves that we're in the presence of God. We may not be literally standing now on holy ground. There are some church communities around the world where it's still customary that when you go into somebody's house, you take off your sandals or your shoes. And there are some churches that adopt that into their culture. And you would find a facility on the church doorway for you to put your sandals and then to put them back on as you leave. That would be false for us, perhaps, to leave our shoes at the door. But we need to remind ourselves that we are tonight in the presence of God. And we need to think about that and to react to that. He's more than just a friend, is he not? And that seems to be the attitude and sometimes the way that God is presented today. He's a friend. But he's more than that. He's more than a friend. I sometimes get a little bit concerned when we offer Jesus to children as a friend. What do they understand by that? Someone they play with in the playground? Someone that comes for tea and they have a play afternoon or whatever it might be? Our God is a holy God, and we need to recognize that. A hymn writer perhaps helps us slightly understand it when he wrote, Jesus, where'er thy people meet, there they behold thy mercy seat. Where'er they seek thee, thou art found, and every place is hallowed ground. There is no single place for us that we might call holy, because we are the people of God and God dwells within us. Then every place is hallowed ground. For thou, within no walls confined, dost dwell with those of humble mind. Such ever bring thee where they come, and going take thee to their home. Wherever we move then, even into our homes, the hymn writer is reminding us that we're in the presence of a holy God. And we need to recognize that. We need to recognize that. Our God is a God that we need to fear and have awe. We might come back to that, I think, in a moment or two. But as the text moves on, we come, of course, to the next point, and it reminds us of a divine intervention. God intervenes into the life of the people in their slavery in Egypt. God has heard them. He's heard their cry. I have come down to rescue. He intervenes. He acts. That's the very nature of our God. He's a God of action. A God who moves. A God who intervenes. A God who reacts. That's our God. The people have been crying out in misery for some time now, wondering, I suspect, why God hasn't intervened before. Where was this God of their father Abraham, of Isaac and Jacob? What was he doing? Why wasn't he doing something? We have no answer to that, do we, really? It's a prayer, perhaps, of people today, or a statement of people today. Where is God in all this? What's he doing? And sometimes we struggle to find the answers. The psalmists were in the same predicament. More than once in the Psalms we'll read, how long, O Lord? How long? How long have I got to suffer this? How long have I got to suffer that? Why aren't you doing something? Why aren't you intervening into doing something? But God is going to intervene now. He's going to react to the situation. He tells Moses that he's heard his people's cry and he's going to rescue them. He's going to rescue them. He's going to come down, and through Moses, he's going to bring the people out of Egypt. But the interesting thing here, of course, that we note, he's going to rescue them and he's going to bring them into a land that's good and spacious, a land flowing with milk and honey. He's going to bring them out and take them back, just as he said he would. But it's interesting to note, isn't it, really, in God's actions, there's always a future plan. There's been debate and discussions recently, hasn't there, when various governments, ourselves and the Americans, have intervened perhaps into some hostile situation. Then just left it. There doesn't seem to be any future plan. They've left the people to their own devices. And often, of course, what they try to rescue them from becomes even worse. Afghanistan, Iraq. We can see those situations. But God says, no, I've got a rescue plan here. I'm not just going to rescue you and leave you to your own devices. I'm going to bring them into a promised land, a land flowing with milk and honey, a large land. I don't think here the mention of the words Hittites and Canaanites, Amorites and the Perizzites has got to do with overthrowing them at this particular juncture. That might happen, but it's going to be a big land, spacious, occupied currently by these tribes. I've got a plan. Another of the allusions that we mentioned this morning of Jesus' plan of salvation in our own lives. He doesn't just rescue us and then leave us to our own devices. He sends his Spirit to indwell us and reminds the people through Paul that he's brought us out of a kingdom of darkness into a kingdom of light. He's pulled us into the presence of his own dear Son. God's rescue plan has always got a future aspect to it. There's always the consequence. For the Israelites, they were to go into a land flowing with milk and honey. We are brought into the kingdom of God. And we can call ourselves heirs and sons of God. We enjoy his presence forever and ever. I was reminded of an old song that we perhaps don't sing at all today. But it reminds us, doesn't it? Out of my bondage, sorrow and night, Jesus I come, Jesus I come. Into the freedom and gladness and light, Jesus, I come to thee. Out of my sickness, into thy health. Out of my want, into thy wealth. Out of my sin, and into thyself. Jesus has prepared something better for us, not just a rescue plan. And God had planned for his people something better. He's rescued them. But the story moves on. The story moves on. Moses is not too keen to go. Memories of Egypt, perhaps still lingering. Although we are made aware that the dynasty at the time has moved on and the incident of Moses and the killing of one of the slave masters perhaps now is a distant memory. He's still concerned to go. I'm still concerned to go. And so he raises four objections, two of which we will deal with this evening. The others come in chapter 4, thankfully, and they can be dealt with next week. Moses now needs to know who this God is that's speaking to him. And he asks the question. And God replies, I am who I am. Who are you, God? I am who I am. We could spend a long time this evening trying to understand that in all its broadness, in all its depth, but we need to remind ourselves that God is going to be with him. He's the God who is. He's the God who's there. He's the God that always cares for his people. The God who's always watching over them. The God who is always there. He was with Joshua as the events of the Exodus unfold and they arrive at the promised land. God is with Joshua. I am with you. I will watch over you, he says. God is with Jeremiah. Don't be afraid, I'm with you. And Jesus says to us, don't be afraid. I shall be with you always, to the very end of the age. Or as someone has paraphrased it, I will be with you day in and day out. God is with the people. God is with the people. He's with Moses. He is the God who is, the God who is. I am who I am. He's the self-existent God. He's not created. He's been there before time began. He will be there from eternity to eternity. He's not dependent on anyone. He is who he is. He's his own person. He's not dependent on anyone, but we are dependent on him. The whole of creation is dependent upon him. He's the one who is unchanging. He's the one who's faithful, as we've just sung. He's the faithful one. He is who he is. I am who I am. I don't change. I'm always the same. Today, tomorrow, forever. I don't change. And because he's faithful to his promises, he says to Moses, you can depend on me. I will be with you. And you'll know that I was with you because you will bring the people out. I'm not sure that's altogether very convincing sometimes. You're given a task and God says, well, you can depend on me when you see the end result. Not always very helpful, but a demonstration of his faithfulness. I will be there, and one of the reasons you know that I'm here and I'm with you is that we will exit. We will exodus out of Egypt. I am who I am. There is one final thing perhaps we need to note. He's the God of self-revelation. He tells us who he is. I am who I am. It's his name. It's not a title. It's his name. And in old ancient cultures, of course, the name means a lot more than it does today. We pick names for a whole variety of reasons. But in this ancient culture, the name meant something. There was an expectation on the part of the parents that it would define the child's character. It would say something about the person. And so when God says to Moses, I am who I am, it's his name. We translate it often elsewhere as Lord. People tell us now that we need to pronounce it as Yahweh. Previously, perhaps we may have pronounced it as Jehovah. Never spoken. How we pronounce it is not important. What we are to see that here is a God who exists without external support. A God who's changeless. A God who reveals himself. We can't change him. We can't change him. Sadly, of course, we do live in a society in a time when people want to refashion God. They want to make him someone he isn't. They want to change his name, if you like. They want to be able to adapt him and make him more appropriate. In my reading, I came across a little story which seems to sum up the point. It's a minister that was holding some seminars on the attributes and character of God. And someone that he calls Bob in this little story was there, and he got very upset with what this minister was saying. And so he interjects and says, Mark, he says, I like to think of God as omniscient, but not meddling. Just, but not nitpicking. Sovereign, but not overbearing. And so he went on and on and on, trying to modify the God, to change his name, if you like. When he'd finished, the minister said, "Thank you, Bob, but we're not here to talk about what you think. We're not here to talk about how you understand your God. We're here to talk about the God of the Bible. And we're going to go back to the Bible and do just that." There's always that danger, isn't there? I was in a group just this past week, and my successor at Woodman Cope was there and was speaking, and someone interjected and says, "I don't think I agree with that. The detail is not important." Except this was the case, that if she didn't agree with that, then the whole gospel message collapsed. There was no good news. Graciously but forcibly, Andrew just said to her, "Well, we can't say that, can we? We can't modify the God. He is who he is. He is the I am who I am." We stand in awe of him, in amazement of him. He's revealed himself to us. He's made his name known to us. He's intervened into the pages of history. He's the God who delivers. He's the God who is changeless. He's the God who is faithful to his word. And we can depend on him. To change him, to rename him, leads us into danger. He is the God who is and was and will be. A changeless God. His name is Lord. But the passage ends now with some divine instructions. Moses is to do three things, God tells him. First of all, he's to go to the people. He's going to leave the family home, the extended family, take his wife and children with him, and go to Egypt. And there he's to go to the people of God, the Israelites. He's to speak to them. He's to say to the Israelites, "The Lord, Jehovah, Yahweh, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, the name you shall call me from generations to generations." The first thing that Moses has to do then is to go and to tell the people of Israel in Egypt that God has heard and God is about to intervene. He is the God of their fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, whose name is forever and forever. The name they are to call him. From generation to generation. Here are the people crying out in misery. But God hears them. He sends Moses to tell them, "I've come, he's coming. That God of your fathers, he's heard, he's about to act." The second thing he is to do is to go to the elders of Israel. He's to say the same sort of things to them. "The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Jacob, Isaac and Jacob, appeared to me and said, I have watched over you. I have seen what's been happening to you in Egypt. And now I'm going to intervene. I'm going to intervene. I'm going to take you out of this slavery and bring you into that land occupied currently by the Canaanites, the Hittites, and all the rest of them, a land flowing with milk and honey, And God makes the assurance to Moses, they will listen to you. They will listen to you. And so they do. Important, perhaps, that Moses gets these tribal leaders, as that's what they are, these elders, people who have some sort of key role, some sort of leadership role amongst the slave community. Senior men. He's to speak to them. He's to tell them that God is coming. God is about to intervene. He needs these elders on board there to play an integral part in God's plan. For they are to go with Moses and speak to the king of Egypt. He's not going to act favorably at first, Moses is told, but he will do in the end. And you will be taken out. God will intervene. God will rescue you. God will take you out. And he'll even, as it were, provide you with the provisions you need to set up in this new land. You'll be given silver and gold, clothing. God is preparing the way. And so the story unfolds. We must leave the rest of it till next Sunday morning. And then, of course, we'll see the people moving into the promised land, completing their wilderness journeys, encountering God again on Mount Sinai. But the key thing here, of course, is that Moses had to go. Moses had to go. He had to trust God. He had to go. He had to come out of the comfort zone of wandering around with a few sheep. He had to go back to the land that he had to flee some 40 years previously. He had to go. The God who was and is and always will be had sent him. There surely must be a connection with us. We are the people of God now. We may not all be Moses in the same way that Moses was called by God to do a specific task. But there must be a task for us to do. For Jesus said to his disciples, and by inference therefore to us, that we had to go. Moses had to put his trust in this God who is changeless, and we have to put our trust in the God who is changeless, who speaks to us through his Son, the one he sent, the one who preceded Abraham, the one who, explaining it to the Pharisees, said, I was before him. I was before him. I am who I am. The problem, of course, is that for us, the going is the difficult part. It is the difficult part. I grew up in a brethren assembly. Some of you might be able to identify with that. Others of you won't, and we needn't explain too more. But every Sunday evening at 6:30, we had a gospel service. Its main objective was to reach out to those who didn't know the gospel, those who were not Christians, those who had not heard the gospel. It was in a residential area in southeast London, surrounded by people. And in the pre-prayer meeting, the prayer meeting that preceded it, some elder always prayed virtually the same prayer. Lord, the doors are open. Please send them in. And as a teenager, I thought, well, that doesn't seem to be quite right, really. The doors were open. But were we not supposed to go out of the doors rather than expect the people to come in? Because if the Great Commission had any value whatever, it says go, not expect them to come. 30 years later, when Ruth and I had left that congregation, and my mother was still part of it, Ruth's mother's moved away, my father had died, it closed. My mother, who wasn't someone who was resident to speak, said, well, of course, we're closing the doors because we never went out of them. We've got a wonderful building. We've got a wonderful environment, all the facilities you could imagine. Spent a lot of money. Paul reminded us of that in his prayer after the offering. But the one thing we didn't spend any time or money on, my mother said, was on evangelism. We never went out to the people. If Moses had never gone, if Moses thought it was too onerous a task and it was too comfortable in Midian, the people of Israel would still be in slavery in Egypt. If there's one lesson for us to take from this Exodus, it is that God has a plan for us. And sometimes we have to go. It may be uncomfortable. Moses found that. He was full of excuses. Two more next week. But in the end, he had to go. Because the task and the consequences were so important. If the people of Israel were to be rescued, Moses had to go. If the people in Cheltenham are to be rescued, we have to go.